are listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. Join him as he and his guests discover how businesses thrive in California.
Well, welcome to Pilgrim on the 405. We're going to hear today from a very significant part of Southern California, that part where we are getting our hair cut. And this is one of the famous haircutters in L.A., Jim Markham. Welcome to the Pilgrim on the 405.
Thank you very much, Will. It's a pleasure to be here, even though I'm in Hawaii.
Yeah, well, that's okay. That's all right. We're talking about how businesses thrive in California. So I'll bet you have a lot to share with us about that.
You know, I did write a book called Big Lucky, and it's about five different companies I've had. And they all thrive, but they each were different. And I think in today's environment with the pandemic, you know, you have to be a little better than you were. You know, you have to develop differences in your service or product. You have to develop that. You have to do more. You have to use social media. You know, if you can't advertise more, there's only really one place to do it, and that's public relations or social media, Instagram, Facebook. You have to communicate with a customer. You have to be better than you were. You have to make that extra step to go get them and be really helpful and do more than you ever did before. I think it's really important that the customers know that.
Now, tell us a little bit about where you came from and how you got to California.
I started in New Mexico. I started out as a barber. I was in New Mexico, and at 15, I was cutting $1.50 haircuts, and I was married and had a child even worse. But I started cutting it in New Mexico, and I started entering competitions and won the national championship and the Olympics of haircutting. And I read in Playboy, interesting enough, that Jay Sebring was charging $50 a haircut in California, in Hollywood, on Fairfax and Melrose. And I was charging $5, and I'd won all these awards. And I called Jay up, and I said, listen, how could you charge 50, 10 times what I'm charging? And I'm the national champion. And he said, why don't you come out here, and let's cut some hair, and let's see if I got something that is better than what you have. So I did. I went to California, and he did a little haircut on one side, and I cut the other side. It's actually Van Johnson's hair. He did have something better than I did. He had a shaping technique that was really much better than what I did. I was good finishing, but he taught me how to shape the haircut. And so it really was a match made in heaven for me.
Well, all right. So did you stay out in California then?
I came to California actually permanently when Jay was killed in the Charles Manson murders. He and Sharon Tate were killed in the Charles Manson murders in August of 69. And I came and took over. I was his successor. I took over the business. Took over his clientele. I took over the products. I bought the whole thing and made it really grow from there. And it did really well. And I stayed. Yes, I did.
All right. So you talk about five businesses. That's one.
And then I did Markham Products. About 8 years later, sold Sebring, started a company called Markham Products, which is my name, and kept that for 7 years and sold that. Then I had another company called ABBA Pure and Natural Product, kept that nearly 8 years and sold that, and started a company called Pureology, which was the biggest company that eventually, 6 years after I started, we sold to L'Oreal for nearly $300 million. And that was a big score. And then a few years after that, I started a company called Colorproof, which was my last company, and that did really well. So I've had 50 years of opening business, starting business, founding businesses, and I love it. Just love it.
Well, what did you learn from that?
You know, one of the things I've learned that I think a lot of people can take away, and by the way, in each chapter of my book, I have takeaways about what to do and examples of how to be successful is, you know, we're all going to fail, and everything we do is not going to be right on, and it's about trying again and getting up, dust yourself off, and try again. We are all really made to win. God made us to win, whether you believe in Buddha or God. I really firmly believe we're made to win, that we have to not get back up to lose. So it's about getting back up, dust yourself off, and keep trying, because you will eventually win if you just keep trying.
All right. So tell me about some of the times that you fell flat on your face and had to get back up.
We ended up having a lawsuit with Sebring, first thing that comes to mind. And there were three partners and we were cast out. And for about a year and a half, I didn't make any money at all. And I was learned to play checkers as a barber from a little old man, a one-legged man in New Mexico, taught me how to play checkers. And I ended up playing checkers with a lot of pimps on Hollywood Boulevard and playing checkers and playing pool to earn a living. So for a year and a half, I was just good enough. I mean, not great, but good enough to win a little bit of money every day.
Oh, my goodness.
So I had to come back, you know, as a big setback. And I ended up coming back and starting another company called Markham Products. So it looked like a big jump. I didn't know if I could make it or not, but I always believed in myself. I had one thing going for me. I believed I could do it if I had a chance. And that was one big setback that I started out. So having to make a living and earn a living was a big setback other than cutting hair.
Well, isn't that really true that if we believe we can do it, the probability we're going to do it is very high?
Very, very high. Because honestly, I don't know if all of us have really different intelligence. We're all good, average intelligence. We got the ability to do everything. It's just having the desire to win and keep getting back up and keep trying and believe in yourself that you can do it. It's really important to believe because you can do it. You can do it. You were made to win. And I illustrate that a lot in my book.
Well, what do you think? Where do you think we get the idea that we weren't made to win?
I think as a child, you know, we're told not to do this and not to do that. And we're often told you can't do this, you can't do that. And I think we learn that there's a lot of things we can't do that we should be able to do. And I think I never had a lot of discipline. You know, I only went to the ninth grade and was then married and had a child to support. And I really didn't hear that so much. I knew I had to do it or wouldn't eat. And I think it's important that people hear they can do it. I think a lot of people are afraid to win as much as they're afraid to lose. There's something about it that they innate in their psyche that they don't afraid to win.
And that's a big word, isn't it? That fear, the fear, right? Whether it's a fear to succeed or a fear to fail. But as long as we're afraid, there's some very significant things that happen.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that when you turn around in that mindset of you can win and believing it, there's nothing you can do, really, when you just develop that mindset. And I think it's a strategy and a process you have to develop. But, you know, keep telling yourself you can win and keep working on that and keep getting back up, because we're all going to fail at different times. We're not 100% successful. You know, success is a lousy teacher. It tells us we're real smart. But, you know, we're going to fail a lot as well.
Well, one of my mentors, David Sandler, always said you don't learn anything from success.
No, that's right.
You learn absolutely zero, but you learn a lot from failure.
That's exactly right. I mean, I fortunately had a lot to learn because I failed a lot. I won a lot. And I always survived each company. I mean, I had to learn really about marketing. I had to learn about sales. I had to learn about warehousing and distribution and inventory control. And I took each one by one, and I learned them quite well. And it takes a while, but I always believed I could do it, interesting enough, and I could do it. And everyone else can do it as well.
And you know, one of my other mentors, Jesus, said, do not be afraid.
Do not be afraid. Well, you know, I think I don't know if I was not afraid. I was scared to death. But I did proceed, and I did believe, and I think the belief in yourself and the belief that in God, or that you're getting help from God, that you're made to win, basically, is a big equalizer for anything.
Well, I guess there was one book, one author, it was a woman who said, be afraid, but do it anyway, something along those lines.
Yeah, that's right. Be afraid and jump in. I think I agree with that. That's you're going to be afraid, but just be afraid not to try. I mean, trying is normal, and trying is something you have to do. You will fall down, you will get back up, you will keep succeeding and keep succeeding. You know, it's kind of like tennis. If you get that ball over the net 51% of the time, and you'll win the game.
That's right. My dad used to tell me that. That's right. You only had to get it one more time over than the other guy.
Yeah, that's it.
That's right. You hit it back every time, you win.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
One of the things that I've discovered in working with companies with the Entrepreneurial Operating System, which is what I teach, EOS, is that so many of them have such a limited picture of where they can be. And they really live in a very short time frame. It's like, can we make it to next week? Can we make it through the year? Can we make it through the next 2 years? Rather than look out 10 years, where do they want to be 10 years from now? And what's the biggest possibility that they could imagine?
That's right. You know, I think it's critically important to develop a business plan and do cash flow analysis and do how much money you're going to need over a 3-year period of time at least, and then see how you're going to get there. I mean, I don't know how you can really start a business without doing a business plan, a cash flow analysis, and what your distribution is, who your target customer is, you know, how do you get there? How do you advertise? Social media plays a big part of my life. I mean, I did a lot of social media, did a lot of interviews around the U.S. and Canada. And instead of advertising, I didn't have the money to advertise, but I could do social media and interviews. Mm-hmm. And that really helped a lot. And I think a lot of companies can do that. They need to put forth an effort to work on social media. It's real important to their business.
So what kind of, tell me some stories about how social media helped you.
Back in the day, when I first started, the Charles Manson and killing Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring was big news worldwide. So when I'd go into, you know, Oklahoma or Philadelphia or New York or wherever, my publicists would line up, you know, the TV, news, radio, the newspaper, and any magazine. So I would go there a couple of days early before I, you know, did an educational event or look for distributors. I just was there. Sometimes I would fly into town and just look for distributors and call in the Yellow Pages and look for the best looking stylist or hairdresser or barber and ask them if I could do a demonstration. I want to show them how to, you know, we started men's hair, so I want to show you how to do the latest hair cutting, and it was free. And that's how I started across the nation. I called Yellow Pages and did a demonstration, and I had to be able to cut hair better than they did, or they wouldn't have wanted to come with me. And so, unfortunately, I was pretty good at that. And then we got a lot of publicity. So I left them with a lot of PR. I left them with the ability to get a lot of customers from being involved with me at that time. So I'd go around, and sometimes I would go in looking for distributors. Sometimes I'd come back and do an educational event and get PR for them as well. So I went all over the U.S. doing that, and I got them started with basically my ability to get PR and tell the Sebring story, the Charles Manson. And that was big news for many, many, still is actually.
I noticed it's having a comeback.
Yeah, the movie that Tarantino did was about that period, actually.
Right. Yeah. Well, all right. So do you ever miss cutting hair?
I do a little bit. I cut about 5 haircuts a month. Yeah. Got some of my friends here, and I do miss it a little bit. I mean, I like it for fun. I don't wouldn't want to stand there and do 10 a day, but yeah, there's a lot. You know, when you're cutting hair, you hear people are saying, "Oh, you're great. I love your work." You know, they're giving you a lot of warm fuzzy. Versus basically, you're not cutting hair. You're hearing a lot of negativity during the day versus warm fuzzy. So I miss that part of it. I missed that for a long time. But it's a great profession. Its ability to make money, you just got to be a little bit more disciplined at it. You have to manage your time better, and you have to try to organize your time. But it did serve me well.
Well, what did you learn in business? What did you learn about personal discipline? What kinds of what was your day like?
I found that I had to get up early and stay late. I'd get up at, you know, 7, be at work at 7:30, and I'd have all my customers lined up, and I did them 45 minutes apart, and I tried to, you know, sometimes I'd just grab a sandwich through lunch, 15 minutes, grab a sandwich and work till six to seven. So I knew that if I, you know, could cut one more haircut a day, that's probably saving. So if I did 10 haircuts and I did 11, that was saving. So I needed to do that extra one. It really made that bit different. So organizing time, get your customers in advance and get them all organized so you can go in and serve them and take care of them and take care of everything else. That's how I did it. I think it's important to do something like that.
When you started the second, third company, the Markham company and the other companies, were you still cutting hair then?
I mostly cut hair for celebrities. I'd cut about five haircuts a week, but that would be Johnny Carson, Frank Sinatra, Paul Newman, Andy Williams, Paul Anka, and I would cut the big celebrities, and that kept my PR potential a lot greater.
Right,
and people
right.
want to know how are they, and so I did that for long, many, many years.
Well, so when you were doing the business other than haircutting, what was your discipline like there?
Well, come in early. I always wanted to come in early. And, you know, I tried to, in the beginning, I didn't really know much about operations. And I really spent a lot of time with people at new operations, learning what they did, learning why they did it, and learning that side of it. And when I felt more comfortable in that, then I'd go over to distribution and warehousing and keeping inventories and having mid-max levels where you didn't want to run out of products, but you couldn't have too much inventory, you run out of money. So, you know, learning those disciplines in each area was critical for me because I didn't really know. So made a lot of mistakes, corrected, I'd run out of money, I'd be back ordered, and I said, I can't do that. I have to be better at this. I have to be the best at it. So I really tried hard, and then I got good people with me that could do it, and that was important to have good people that can manage that area of the business. Then I could focus on, you know, opening up distributorships. And I did a lot of education. Like I did, you know, some national championships where they use, you know, get together and they compete for the best state champion and then national champion. I did it with Sebring and Markham and ABBA and Purology. And that was important to keep stylists interested and they liked that. So I did classes. I always had, it was a, whether it's a 400 or 500 people show, I did those. I did personal education, I did those. So I was training all the time and opening distributors all the time. It's pretty much what I did.
Ah, so this was part of expanding your distribution network for the company.
Yes. That was critical. So I started making barbers distributors for a small area. Like they might have two distributors in Albuquerque and they distribute to other barbers and hairstylists in Albuquerque. So, you know, then as we went along with Markham, I started getting like four distributors for Albuquerque. I expanded the distribution territory. So making barbers distributors, I don't think anybody ever did that before or since. Mm-hmm. But it worked because it was new and men's hairstyle was brand new. And everybody really interested in it once they saw it. And then we started daily shampooing and conditioning for men. Back then, you know, men would wash their hair maybe once every week or two. Use Vitalis or Brill cream on their hair, and they needed to use that or couldn't comb it. If they washed their hair, they couldn't comb it with that Butch wax or Brill cream or Vitalis. So we taught them to wash their hair, cut it in the way it grows, and do it daily, and they could take care of it because they comb it the way it grows. And the hair grows either clockwise or counterclockwise. Nobody's hair grows back. So we went from the pompadours going back to the right side or to the left side and cut good shape in it, and it was just revolutionary. I mean, it was amazing how men would start wearing the bell bottoms. I started noticing people getting divorces and buying convertibles. And I mean, life's changed. It was really an amazing time of life for me.
So change your hair and change your life, huh?
Yeah.
All right. So now that must have been a heady experience to be cutting hairs for all these celebrities. What was that like?
Boy, it was amazing. You know, what I learned mostly was how their lifestyle. I thought it was just amazing that Paul Newman, he really was kind to me and he let me stay in his hotel room. And he went back to, he was in Tucson making the movie Pocket Money And he said, Markham, he said, your room's lousy. He said, why don't you just stay with mine while I'm gone? So I observed from Paul and Joanne the lifestyle that was amazing. I never saw before. And I saw Johnny Carson and Frank Sinatra, and their lifestyles was amazing. And I think I learned about kindness from Paul and generosity from Paul. Of course, I saw that a lot from a lot of them, and their lifestyle of living better. And that's really what I wanted for myself, to live the best I could, to have a little honor in my life as opposed to what I used to see. And Paul had such great honor and integrity in Joanne. And a lot of them did. I mean, you know, Sinatra and Paul Anka, and all of them was really, I thought, just really good to be around. I learned a lot from being around as people.
Talk about lifestyle. What elements of the lifestyle did you find him?
You know, having a beautiful house, having a maid that worked to care of them, having a right food, eating the right food, reading books, having the right decor, living in the right location, having the right dishes and silverware and the right cars. And, you know, I just admired that a bunch. And I saw what they did to do it. And they work hard. You know, the actors work very hard and they're very disciplined because they get undisciplined too. And I observed that. And I thought, okay, I got to be better. I got to keep being better because they're better. And I learned a lot, I think, particularly from Paul. Of course, Steve McQueen was my buddy for a while. I ran around with Steve, and he was quite the guy, a lot of fun. And then Wolfman Jack was a great friend of mine for years and years. And then Peter Lawford was a great friend as well. So, no, I learned a lot from those guys. Charming, charming people.
So talk a little bit more about your book. How did you get started on writing a book?
You know, I've been told for 20 years, listen, from where you came from and to where you got to, you should write a book. And so I wrote this book, Big Lucky. Took me 19 months to write it. I kept being asked, why don't you write a book about your life? And finally I said, you know, maybe I do have something to share from five companies over 50 years and to tell my story of how to get from $1.50 barber, married at 15, to where I'm at now, which is pretty fairly successful. I've got a lot of lessons there. I failed a lot. I jumped up and got back in. And I think a lot of people need to see that they can fail. They can win. You can do it. And after each chapter, I have a section. I talk about how to do it and how to go about it. So each chapter has answers to those questions. And I thought that was important to tell a story about how to do it, how to be successful.
Tell us some of the things that you wrote about. Oh, I want to ask you about the writing itself. So that took a lot of discipline. How did you go about doing the writing?
Well, it really did. I mean, we'd work 4 to 5 hours a day. I worked with a writer, and we'd work 4 to 5 hours a day, probably 5 days a week, for 19 months. I worked with one writer for a while, and I thought it needed a little tweaking. It wasn't quite as good as it needed to be. And I ended up with 3 different writers. And it took a lot of discipline, a lot of trial and error. I think we got it where we wanted it to be.
Well, we're going to take a little break here. We're going to come back, and I want to hear more about how you wrote it. And then also, I want to get some of the stories from the book. I want you to maybe even read some to us.
All right.
We'll be right back.
Okay.
Would your business survive a disaster? Nearly two-thirds of businesses aren't prepared for an emergency. And 40% of businesses that experience a disaster never recover. Make an emergency plan now before it's too late. For a free online tool that helps you develop an emergency plan to keep your business up and running should disaster strike, visit ready.gov/business. Brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the American Red Cross, and the Ad Council.
All right, so here we are again. So tell me a little bit more about the discipline of writing.
You know, you just schedule a call a day, at least 5 days a week with the writer. And she lived in Georgia, and I lived in California. And we would take, you know, at least 4 hours to 5 hours to 6 hours most days for nearly that entire period. It took a total of 19 months to finish. But I think I've worked with her 16 months. But the discipline to do that, you just got to sit down and dedicate the time and try not to get distracted and put the time in and try to recall memories, try to recall smells, sights, what you felt, how you felt about things. And it was a really interesting process, I think, to do.
Well, so maybe you can pick out some stories and tell us about them, or even maybe even read some.
Okay. I think I'll tell you about when we started Curology. I just finished ABBA product, and I had a lady named Terry that was a friend of Cheryl, Carrie. And Carrie called me up. She said, "Jim, I want you to write up. I want you to develop products for me that do not have cancer-causing ingredients." Because most of the ABBA products you developed had carcinogens, and my oncologist says that you really can't use these products. So I set out to make a product for Carrie, and I did it without vegan, no animal ingredients, not animal tested, carcinogen free. A different surfactant, sulfate free. And we did that for Carrie, and then Carrie died. I mean, it worked for Carrie, but she died, and that's when we developed Curology, and we took it and made it for Color Treat. That's one particular story. But during the writing process, you know, there would be moments where they were teary-eyed, and hard to get through those periods. But I think it's important to get through those periods and recall those periods, kind of feel the feeling and let it go.
All right. All right. So how about reading something from your book?
Okay. It had been 4 years since I'd launched my namesake company, Markham Product. Christmas around the corner, and I suddenly felt nudged to visit my mother. I haven't been back home for the holidays in years. The lights shone beautifully, marking the town with a magical holiday spirit. But for me, they made a sad reminder that my early childhood Christmases that had gone uncelebrated. I rarely allowed myself a melancholy moment, but those painful memories brought heavy emotions on me. My brother and wife and kids now live near mom and Hobbs. Dad had come into town to stay with Bobby for the holidays, and I'd planned to stay at mom's current place. I wasn't sure how long she'd been in the rental. She had a new boyfriend by that point, yet another alcoholic. She had been living with him for a while. Mom met me on the front porch, and she immediately wrapped me in a big hug and then clapped her hands in delight. "I'm so glad you're here," she said. "I made all your favorites, fried chicken, mashed potatoes, and gravy with cornbread. And for dessert, I've got pies, pumpkin, apple, and cherry." Too many memories were flooding back. A few of them were good. In silence, Mom gave me a maternal hug. She seemed to sense that despite all I've achieved since leaving home, what I needed most was to feel loved, to be given the reassurance of a mother's nurturing touch. We didn't talk, but in the quiet of the home, I felt the hot score of anger slowly start to melt away. In my heart, I forgave her for all the time she had left me unprotected, for abandoning me over and over again, when I was young and vulnerable and in need of a safe place to call home. I forgave myself too, letting go of guilt I've been carrying for being helpless to save her from many demons. At that moment, I knew without a doubt that my mother, although deeply flawed, loved me the best she could. I spent the first day of Memorial Day weekend, 1977, partying at a Steve McQueen beach house. I returned home late that night to a blinking message light on my answering machine. I punched the button, and my mother's voice was shrieking at me. Jim, he's going to kill me. He's going to kill me this time. She was slurring her words before the message ended. Two more messages followed, each one with more fear and urgency in her voice. About that time, my phone rang. It was my brother. "Mom's been shot," she said. "You better get here quick if you want to see her." I immediately flew from Roswell, New Mexico, where I rented a car and raced the rest of the way to Hobbs. I learned Mom had fallen off the wagon. She and her boyfriend had tangled in an argument. During the fight, she managed to block him in the house, but he shot through the door, hitting Mom. who'd been standing in front of the door to block his way, his entrance. It had been sliced through her terminal artery just above her leg. In a panic, her boyfriend waited 45 minutes before calling the police and telling them what he'd done. By the time she reached the hospital, she had already lost an enormous amount of blood. When the nurses hustled me in to see her, she was clinging to life. Her eyes were open, but she was paralyzed.
Oh, my goodness. That's powerful.
Tears full from my eyes. I'm here. I've barely gotten the words out when she flatlined. Blood of panic as I hustled her out. As they hustled her out, the doctors tried desperately to resuscitate her. But I hadn't prayed much since. Sorry, Will.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's wonderful. I mean, that is a
powerful story. That's all I can read.
Well, that is a powerful story. My goodness.
It was a powerful story. But it's a powerful moment, actually, that she ended up dying. And then I got with my kids, who I hadn't seen in years. They had been adopted by another person, another man. And so we got back together then for the first time in many years. And they had been adopted and had another name. And since then, they've readopted, get their name back. So, yeah, the trials and tribulations I went through was pretty dramatic. And the comeback was pretty strong, too. So I try to make it a point to tell my story as honestly as I could and give examples of how to be successful when you're in these sort of turmoils. I mean, we're all going to go through different ones.
You know, the courage to share that is really, really laudable, to share the kind of struggle that you went through, not only growing up, but also going back for that experience. That's got to be very encouraging. Now, a question for you. Mm-hmm. Did that experience stop you from doing things?
Not at all. My mom had always told me, she said, "You're smart. Why are you smarter than the other kids?" Which is my brother and sister. And you know, I always remember that. She's telling me that. And that of things that really stuck with me, that stuck with me. So I was more determined than ever. I had my kids back finally. And I was in, I think I was in Mark Product at that point. And then we went on and, you know, then I started three more companies after that. So no, it didn't slow me down at all. In fact, if anything, I accelerated.
Well, I think that's a really important witness to the power that we all have, that ability to move through difficult times.
Yes.
And to still thrive, still succeed.
Absolutely. You know, the only thing going to hold you back is you. You know, you can do it. And you really should. I've been a big dreamer and dream big and was fortunate enough to have opportunities to do things. But it takes a lot of ability, but you know, it takes a lot of willpower to lose as well. I mean, the same amount of willpower to win is the same as losing. You just got to apply yourself and go for it. And that was an intricate moment for me when my mother died. But I never let it stop me at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have known people who have mourned a loss, a death, for years and years, and it certainly distracted them from succeeding or from achieving what they wanted out of life.
Yeah, I have as well, and you've heard people say, "Well, I'm Catholic, or I'm this, or I'm that, therefore I can't do X," or my mother told me this, and therefore I can't do X. But, you know, it's not true. You know, it's you're in control of your destiny. You're in control of your thoughts. I try to make it a point to think as many positive thoughts as I can. Because you can think negative or you think positive. I want to choose to. Sometimes I'll get off and start thinking negative like we all do. But I try to, if I ever start feeling a little negative or a little down, I say, okay, I'm in control of my thoughts. Let's think positive thoughts. Let's think, what do you like? What do you like to do? What's fun for you? Where do you want to go eat tonight? What do you want to do? Where do you want to go? So that's important, I think, to try to self-discipline your emotions.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right. So talk to me a little bit about what are you excited about in the next year?
We just bought another house in Newport, and we're excited about remodeling that. We're living in Hawaii now, and it's great over here. It's a great spot. We're going to look at other businesses to see if we want to do one more business.
Oh.
And hair care. We think we got one more left. You know, in businesses, you got to develop a point of difference. You have to look and see what your in your area, mine being hair care, what is your competition doing that do they do well? What could they do better? And try to build a company based on what you can do better than your competition. What points of differences, you got to develop them. And that's, I do that well.
Well, that's what entrepreneurs do, isn't it? Entrepreneurs take something.
I really do. I love developing companies, and I love working on different projects like that. Although we're not really so interested now, and we're interested in, you know, we're promoting a book, we're working on a book, we're doing we did some things that make it look cosmetically better, and writing the book was such a interesting process, and I think sharing the haves and how to do things and what you're going to fail at and what you're going to win at and keep going is an important part of life. And that's been fun. And so we're promoting the book and working on the book and doing some seminars and stuff around the country.
Oh, nice. Nice. So you're going to be back on the road, huh?
A little bit. Yeah. The road's not too bad. You know, I mean, I was raised on the road, you know, doing shows and seminars and stuff all around the country. So I kind of like being on the road. Kind of interesting. Of course, I like getting back home too. So as I've gotten older, it's a little bit harder to go on the road. But
yeah, yeah. So you got a house in Newport Beach?
Yeah, Newport Beach. Yes, and we've actually had a house there before. We just bought another one. But yeah, Newport Beach is great. Love Newport Beach.
I'm just down the road from that. I'm in Laguna Beach.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, we're right on the edge there. Right on the edge. Like walk 50 feet and you're in Laguna.
Yeah, yeah. Super. Very
beautiful
nice.
Beautiful area.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It really is. We're blessed. Absolutely blessed. Well, so what would you like to tell folks, Jim? You got the megaphone for a while. What would you like to tell them?
I just like to say, you know, be happy with where you're at and be unhappy where you're at. I think, you know, you gotta think about where you're at, think about what you can do, and then try to build a plan, a map, look down and get a piece of paper and put down what you want to do and what your obstacles are and what lies ahead. And I outline that a lot in my book, Big Lucky. How to do different things, how to get up after failing. But I outline a lot after each chapter. I have takeaways that I think are important for entrepreneurs and other people that want to get better and be more successful.
Excellent. Show us a cover again, because this book is available right now on Amazon, probably in local bookstores. So Big Lucky by Jim Markham.
Thank you so much, Will. It's really a pleasure being with you, man.
Good. Enjoyed being with you. Look forward to seeing you back here in Newport Beach soon.
We'll be back. Take it easy, man.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Here's just one more example of how businesses in California, even up in Hollywood, thrive.
You've been listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist.